Paratayan Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamuna Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. So, chapter 12, verse 7 still.
What chapter?
13. Chapter 13. Thank you. See that yellow thing? That yellow marker? Om Amani Twamadham Bitwam Amani Twamadham Bitwam Ahim Sakshanti Rajavam Ahim Sakshanti Rajavam Acharyo Pasanam Shaucham Acharyo Pasanam Shaucham Staryam Atma Vinigraha Staryam Atma Vinigraha Amani Twam Adhambitvam, Ahimsa, Kshantihi, Arjavam, Acharya, Upasanam, Shaucham, Stairyam, Atma, Vinigraha. So, we went over pretty thoroughly Amanitvam and Adhambitvam. Right, those are the only two we really did. We have to do the rest of them. Ahimsa. For those of you who don't know, this is a very famous section in the Bhagavad Gita. It's chapter 13, verse 7 through 12, or so the next five verses. They're all of the qualities or the values that, say, a seeker or a sannyasi or a mumukshu aspires to, and values that are actually very natural to the jnani, to the one who has maturity, to the mature person who has knowledge. And so these values, they're listed out, and each value, we go over each value really as not a should, like you should do this, but rather as something to really understand and to gain a value for it. Swamiji wrote a whole book called The Value of Values, right, where he's taken each one of these and unfolded it very, very thoroughly, actually, so that you have an understanding of the value and the reasons why these values are actually valuable. So you gain a value for the values. Because these values really, as we grow into them, they give the mind a relative shanti, a relative peacefulness, you know, kind of a saucham, a cleanliness, you know, that really becomes a beautiful container for this knowledge and resonates well with this knowledge. And in fact, as we go through each one of these values, usually our recognition is these are the values that we do value, you know. When we're not kind of in line with these things, with all of these, this whole list of values, when we're not really in line with them, we don't feel very comfortable. And so it's natural for us, just as human beings, to aspire toward these things. But as we understand them, then more and more you gain a value, kind of a what's in it for me type of value. You know, like for instance, when we go through the Ten Commandments, you know, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. They're like rules. But even though they're like rules, but even when you think about them, you don't disagree with the rules. But at the same time, you may never have spent a lot of time contemplating upon why these rules or these so-called commandments are advantageous to me. Why are they important for my own well-being, for my own shanti? And so this is kind of the same thing. You can take them as commandments, you know, or you can take them as, you can understand them. And how it's why it's so important for us, you know, to keep them in mind, so that when you're not, when you're falling sway to one of these, these things, you understand why you want to pull your mind back from it, because it's not in your best interest, something like that. Okay, so the one that we're on now is ahimsa. Ahimsa means non-injury, not hurting. And of course, there's many, many different ways that we do injure people and we do hurt people. Like in war, for instance. You know, there's different circumstances where we do injury. But the idea is to have that ahimsa. Ahimsa means to injury, to injure, to hurt, to kill, to maim. The negates it, to not do that, to not cause harm, to not cause pain, to not injure, to not kill. You know? And so you have to understand it kind of as, let me not injure another person, create harm for my sake. For my sake, let me not do that. Sometimes I'm in a situation where that has to happen, like for instance a soldier in war. But I'm not doing that for my sake. So there's a difference. There's a lot of subtlety, there's a lot of dharma around, a lot of flexibility around himsa. You know? And so you have to kind of understand the situation in which that takes place. And so I think that let me not do it for my sake, Swamiji says it like that. That kind of understanding is very important. And then he'll go on, like for instance, because Swamiji can never help himself about this. Don't eat meat. You should all be vegetarians. I'm not telling you to be vegetarians. It's Swamiji. Everyone should be a vegetarian. Why? Because you don't need to eat meat to live. And every human being, every living being, wants to live. And so just as you want to live, others also want to live. Just as you want to be treated, you know, fairly and your life protected, others want to be treated fairly and for their life to be protected. Just as you don't want to be hurt on an emotional level, others don't want to be hurt. And so there's an empathy there. It's not that we don't know that, know this. We know that we don't want to be hurt. And we also know that other people don't want to be hurt on every level, really. But even though we know this, we can push it to the side, you know. We can push that very natural, intuitive, or almost instinctual, knowing that instinctual, intuitive empathy, we can override it just because of our desire, or really, really, it's really because of our raga dvesha. We can override our natural empathy toward ahimsa, toward non-injury, on emotional, on every level. We override it because of our own raga dvesha. Raga dvesha means our own likes and dislikes. And so, an example, just to show you how that works. It's not directly, it happens indirectly. So for instance, I need something. In my mind, this raga means what I need to be happy, my desires. And dvesha are the negative desires, what I don't need, what I want to get rid of, my dislikes. So these raga dveshas, they will operate like this. I need this to be happy. Certain things are obstructing. You know how the world is. I need this to be happy, but that doesn't mean that Bhagavan just throws it at me. Okay, you do, here. It's not like that. And so I'm going to run into obstacles as I try to fulfill my desires. And I'll have people who are helping me, people who are not, situations that are conducive, situations that are not. But as long as my need is there, there's a passion there, there's a burning, a longing for it, that longing for having something in a particular way, or how I want it, or how I need it, will override that empathy, can often override that empathy, can override the value. So it can override that value for ahimsa. And so in order for my raga dvesha not to override the ahimsa, that value, I have to value ahimsa more than my raga dvesha. And I think this is true for all of these. These values, I have to value more than the fulfillment of my raga dvesha in order for the value to hold sway. See what I mean? Otherwise, I'll just move toward the value and push that out of the way. And if I have to bark at somebody or cause pain to somebody or do something, it just automatically happens in one way or another, and I barge through and get what I want. But when we start analyzing the barging through to get what I want, even if it's at the expense of the well-being of another person or the expense of the well-being of the situation at a whole, if you stop for a minute to analyze your own internal situation, what you realize is that the fulfillment of your desire, the joy that you were expecting to get, is muted and hurt. The joy itself of the fulfillment of the desire is muted or hurt by the himsa that was involved in your attaining it. So that just becomes subtle, subtle thing. There's certain things in the creation and in our society that we are so accustomed to that we don't think about it, and we don't think about it, and nor do we want to think about it. You know, and so we don't even like to hear about it. We don't like to hear about it. This vegetarian thing is one of them. We don't like to hear about it. When you think about it, you know, then if you start to think about it, then you stop yourself from thinking about it. This is really interesting. You know, I'm just giving you a little bit of Swamiji, just because if you can this is just so graphic. But if you can understand it in reference to this and how the mind works and how dull the mind can become around these type of things, you can apply it to other things. You know? And just to make it clear, this vegetarian thing, all over the world, including all over India, it's really only the Brahmins in India that are that are totally committed to being vegetarian, and not all Brahmins. There's Kshatriyas, and even Krishna was eating meat, this type of thing. But a jnani or a seeker, or someone like that, this has to become something that you are conscious of. Because if you're it's something that you can easily become conscious of now, and that will allow you to become conscious of other things that are completely blocked out. So I'm just going to tell you these things, how it works, because it's interesting, actually, how the mind can totally block out something which, upon when you think about it, it's unacceptable. You know? And I think that this vegetarianism or meat eating is a beautiful example of that, because we're Westerners, and all of us, whether we're vegetarian or not, all of us have experienced this, that you can go to the grocery store and buy meat, come home, fry it, and eat it, the whole time not having a thought about what that is and what has happened to that creature, to that animal. You can actually just do it. You can just buy it and eat it without thinking at all about what happened to it. And if somebody starts talking to you about what actually goes into bringing that meat to the table from beginning to end, that's the last thing you want to hear about. Because it's so unacceptable. It's so completely unacceptable. But we've learned from childhood and from generations how to not think about it. Because we're used to eating meat. We're used to going to restaurants. It's very involved. It's a social life also. Mm-hmm. You know? We have taste buds. And we've learned to have a taste for that. We've also been taught that meat, or at least chicken and fish, you know, are really part of the diet. And you really need that as a human being. You know, there's the pyramid scale. So the pyramid scale has been totally redone. You know, the pyramid scale is not true. It makes everybody just obese. But anyway, keeping that aside, we all have rationalizations to participate in acts of cruelty. And I'm using this one because it's so obvious, and we all cringe when we think about it, and we don't want to think about it, and so we just let meat be like a vegetable that you buy at the store, you know. But what I'm seeing with this, using this graphic illustration of meat, because we can all experience our own relationship to it and all our own rationalizations to it, you can think about it now on more subtle levels in how we can actually be just as blind to causing hurt to others. Somebody irritates me. I have harsh words, you know. Or somebody's doing something wrong, I have harsh words. Or I gossip, or I do all of these things, so many different things that are actually himsa. But we've had these blinders on. And so what happens, say, when we start really working and contemplating on each one of these values, the blinders start coming off. Now this himsa is considered, the ahimsa is considered central, really, to being a mumukshu, to being a jnani, to being a sannyasi. The whole, the major kernel, the major vowel of ahimsa is in taking sannyasa is called abhayam. Non-injury, non-fear. Abhaya means fear. And so you think, the vow is this, may I, from this point on, now that I'm taking this orange, now that I'm taking this ritual, from this point on, may no being be afraid of me. And the other side of it is, may I not be afraid of any being. That's ahimsa, right? Because himsa is what evokes fear, injury. You know? I can harm you. I will harm you. Or you will harm me. So abhaya is really that vow of fearlessness, means that freedom from himsa. So no, may I not be a threat to any living creature. With Swamiji, he was such, it was and is such an example of this in a totally non-phony way. To the point he would not, because I remember at the ashram when we would walk, you know, from our, we would meet him as he was going to walk all the way down to the classroom. And in India, you know, they have so many beautiful flowers, just beautiful, so many different varieties. And when he would walk, he would appreciate these flowers, but he would never pick one. He would never pick one because why would he end the flower's life? It's a sensitivity. Even in India, of course, they grow up with this also, where before they cut the fields, cut the grass in the fields, they always say some chants and prayers because they're cutting the, it's a sensitivity. They're killing the grass, and so they'll do some rituals and ask for the grass's permission from the grass to allow it to be cut. So I've just noticed all this time he'd never pick a flower, because why would he loves the flower. It's a sensitivity, you know, it's a value that's been developed. We'd pick his pick the ants up off the shower and take them outside because he didn't want to kill them all going down the drain. Sensitivity. It can sound extreme, but actually it's not that extreme really when you think about it. I'll tell you what extreme is. The Jains in India, have you ever seen the Jainas? This is how far things can be taken. The Jains will, they wear all white and they wear a mask around their face, and they walk with a brush, like a little broom, a very light feathery broom. And as they walk, they just sweep in front of them to sweep away any insects or creatures that might be there. And they wear this mask so they don't inhale any. That's taking it to the farthest extent. But there's some sort of a balance, you know. I'm not even saying one thing or another. What I'm doing is talking to you about that particular sensitivity, you know, and empathy. What is so important to you, your life, not being hurt, is as important to all creatures, all beings, not just human beings, to all plants and to all insects and to all animals. It's all kind of the same. They don't want to be injured, and you don't want to be injured. And so Dharma, you know, the general rule, the golden rule that is actually in different forms and in many different religions, do unto others as you would have done to yourself. And in India, it's do unto others as you would have do to others as you would have done to yourself, and don't do to others as you wouldn't want done to you. They have both sides of it. That's what's called the Sadharana Dharma, the general Samanya, the Dharma, the overriding Dharma. All the other Dharmas fall under this, you know. So it's a general Dharma. And this Ahimsa is up there also as maybe the general overarching Dharma. Do not cause pain to others. Because pain or hurt to others, you know, then can be broken down in so many ways. Don't cause this kind of pain, and don't cause this kind of pain, and don't cause this kind of pain. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not cause pain. Thou shalt not hurt. And you can just have one big word, ahimsa. Don't hurt. You know. And then we have all of the varieties of that. So now, the thing is, the way the creation seems to work, Dharma seems to work, I find that as I do a dharma, as I go against these laws, which are can be all fall under this ahimsa, if I go against this general law ahimsa, then not only is the other hurt, I am also hurt. Right? It's not that I hurt the other person and I'm not hurt. And so, becoming sensitive to that. To that fact, that in the hurting of another person, I am also hurt. In the hurting of another being, I am also hurt. It might be subtle, it might not be something that stands out for you, but one way to notice that, is to stop doing one way that you hurt another, to stop doing that, and then see how you feel. And that practice is something that gives a lot of strength and depth to my own state of mind. So it's all of these things are a practice. It's not a practice to condemn yourself. It's a practice like when you don't do it, oh, I'm a bad person because I'm not following this. It's not that at all. That will work against you. It's having it as a value to aspire to, and then watch your mind grow and mature in the light of that value. And the rewards for that are very high. The rewards are very high. So ahimsa becomes something which that word itself, I really like abhayam myself. Ahimsa, non-injury. But abhayam has a little, it's the same in a way, but has a little different quality. Let no one be afraid of me. You know, and not don't let me be afraid of others. I still remember, you probably heard this story from me, but I like it so much, that once Swamiji, when he was kind of a young brahmacharya, just became a sannyasi, one of his devotees called him in the middle of the night, like 2 or 3 in the morning. Swamiji was just kind of young at that time. Called him like at 2 or 3 in the morning, and Swamiji says, hello, you know. And then the devotee was very worried about something. And he couldn't sleep, so he called Swamiji and woke him up. and so they talked, and Swamiji, they worked out whatever the fear was and all of that, and then hung up. And then Swamiji's thought was that he just loved that person trusted in him enough to call him. you know, because he wasn't afraid of him. That was it. There was that, because he was talking, actually he was only talking to me at that time. He might have told this to other people, but it was that Abhayam. What is that?
Some tune.
It might be my thing.
Sorry.
What thing?
This is your operator.
Is the battery dead?
Yeah. No, but it stopped.
It went down.
I don't know why.
Well, I think mine's working. You can have mine. So anyway, that's that he had an appreciation of that. Because for him also, I think he was a sannyasi or young sannyasi at that time, that abhayam was the strongest value. You know, and he experienced it. You know, this person was not afraid of him to be able to call him in the middle of the night and wake him up. And it was true. Mm-hmm. I think that's really, it's a nice way to look at it. He trusted him enough to bring his problems to him. Even in the middle of the night. And Swamiji won't mind if I wake him up. So anyway, that's ahimsa. Swamiji doesn't, in his book, the Gita Home Study, he doesn't have too much on this. But this is basically what he talks about a lot. And the things that I've found valuable. I've found this not eating meat, even though sometimes I do, not very often. But I have that value. I understand it as a sensitivity. And I understand it as a sensitivity that we did not grow up with. Mm-hmm. And so that means when we don't grow up with a certain sensitivity, the mind is naturally a little bit coarse. It's trained from childhood to not be sensitive in this area. And the unpleasantries around it, to somehow we're able to block it out. And that's just a gross example that I know that all of us can relate to. I certainly can relate to it because I didn't grow up as a vegetarian. So I know what that type of insensitivity is. And if you can appreciate what the mind is capable of doing, the level of rationalization that the mind is capable of, you can then really bring that understanding to your own sensitivities that you want to cultivate in lesser ahimsas. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's kind of deep. Now the next one, kshantihi. Kshanti. And Swamiji has in his Gita Home Study, has written really a lot on kshanti. He even went so far as to say that this kshanti is perhaps the most important of all of the values. And kshanti is, sometimes we just say accommodation. But what it really means, what does accommodation really mean, is if a person, for instance, does something wrong to you, creates harm, yells at you, says something rude to you, does something to you that is hurtful, what naturally arises is what we call a vikriya. It's some form of retaliation. It can only come just in your mind, or it can come in your mind and then out your mouth. You can act it out. It's a retaliatory response. Because that person has done, you know, a negative action towards you. Truly a negative action. Negative in the sense that it's meant to hurt or it's meant to harm. And so the response is to retaliate in one form or another. And accommodation is the absence of that response. To come to a place where that response is not something that occurs. Initially it'll just occur mentally, can occur physically, then it'll occur mentally, but for that response to actually, a retaliatory response is to actually not occur, means that you're viewing the relationship or you're viewing the person from a totally different perspective. And that perspective has to do with much more than just the action of the person that you're experiencing, but also who they are, and wondering from where that action comes. There's an understanding that Like for all of us humans, we all have a history. We all have parents. We all have a situation that we were born into and raised in. And that history creates kind of a value system and makes us who we are. Also involved in that history is our own work that we've done on ourselves, but whatever it is, it makes us what we are. And that what we are at that given time allows for certain responses to take place. And so if somebody is behaving toward me in a particular way, I'm either in a place to, like, retaliate or just simply react to the response that's coming, or I'm more interested in that person. I'm interested in that person on a deeper level. Or trying to understand more what's going on with that person to make that person react in that way. If that's my focus, which for a therapist, actually, that is the focus. You know, when you're, but for just as an aside, if you're a therapist and you're meeting with your client 1 or 2 hours a week, then you're set up with that type of therapeutic stance where the interest, you're not taking it personally, the acting out of the client against you or for you or whatever. You're trying to be helpful. You're trying to understand what's really going on there. What are the layers behind all of that that would cause such a reaction or would cause that type of meanness, right? So here there's kind of a, it's almost like there's a therapeutic eye in the sense that you're not just, you're not condemning the person by the behavior. The person's not condemned. The behavior is something that you want to understand. What is that about? And you know what? That kshanti is not just external. It has to go inward also when you're acting out in one way or another. You can have the akshanti, which is the opposite, meaning no accommodation, where you can have that vikriya, that acting out toward your own behavior, condemning your own behavior, being angry at your own behavior, retaliating at yourself against yourself because of the way you were behaving. Or you could have kshanti, internally also, where you try to understand, where is that coming from? What is that? You know? What is going on there? When that's the stance, when you develop that stance, then you're not receiving. It's much different. You're not receiving or swallowing or taking inside, you know, the hurt that's being dished out. You're rather the focus is on what is the other person going through? Why is that taking place? And so it's not coming here. It's staying there, and you're in a mode that is helpful. Same internally. That's kshanti. That's real accommodation. And that is such a value to be practiced, because otherwise we're kind of like a springboard in a way. You know? You throw this at me, I catch it and throw it back like that. You know? One therapist who I really, psychologist called Donald, his name is Donald Winnicott. I love this particular psychologist who's written a lot, you know. He's used often this word metabolize. That when somebody is attacking you in some way, you can receive that with interest and trying to understand, and then give back, metabolize it, and give back something else. You know? Take it, metabolize it, and give back something else. Just like you would want somebody to do for you. Yeah, it's very nice. I mean, if you are upset and raging and acting out and misbehaving in this way or that way, you know, and somebody is able to really help kshanti and accommodate you and say, what's going on? Why are you so upset? What's happening? You know? It's so nice to have somebody care about you like that. Swamiji uses the example often of, and I've actually experienced this with a mother that I know. If you're holding a little baby, You know? He uses the example of a father holding his little son, who's maybe 4 or 5 months old, and just having the worst temper tantrum. You know? Have you ever seen a baby have a temper tantrum? It's amazing. Their whole body is into it. And they're so furious, and their little mouth, their face is all red, and their eyes are watering, and their mouth is screaming. Their little body is going like this, and kicking, kicking, kicking. And so this little baby is just pummeling the father, you know, with his little kicks in his fists. He's so upset and so angry. And the father's just holding him and patting him and trying to help him, and, you know, helping to calm down, you know. There's nobody there saying, you know, what in the hell are you doing? There's no authority, there's no strong father there. There's no punishing father there. There's a father that's trying to help, you know. Then he says, Swami will say, but of course if that boy's 15 or 16 and doing that, then you have to have another, you have to have another perspective. You already have innate in you the perspective of how to handle a little baby that's kicking like that. You know the baby's innocence. But with a 15 or 16 year old, or say another adult, when they're acting out in some way, we're not necessarily prepared to not immediately have some sort of retaliation. And so these understandings become sadhanas, which are important to me. They're values that are important to me for my own wholeness, for my own peace, for my own sense of well-being. And the wonderful thing about these values, the values like Shanti, like all of them, is that the values themselves are very rewarding. In other words, as you practice a value, the mind, Bhagawan gives you a treat. You know, he gives you a karmapola. He gives you a reward. You're rewarded for it. And the reward is the very natural relative shanti, peace, here shanti, the peace that you get. This one, shanti, the shanti that you get, I'm talking, the peace of mind that you get. And that peace makes you want more. You know, it's just like anything. If something that you do rewards you with peace or with anand or with happiness, you want to do it more. It's just what's happening here is that these values are really their dharmas that belong to human beings, to your very human structure. They're not rewards as what like fulfilling a desire. They're actually a much deeper reward, because the value is you. Let me put it this way: you have some control over your values, much more control over your values than you have over fulfilling your desires. And so, to the degree that those values become embodied in you, to that degree, your mind is rewarded by a natural shanti, a natural peace. And as I understand that, I understand it through experiencing it, the mind becomes more and more in line, more and more committed to those values because I'm rewarded by them. I'm rewarded by a peace of mind that not only I enjoy, I'm also rewarded by the peace of mind that others enjoy. Because you do affect the people that you're around. We don't always realize that. And that to me is staggering, talking about even myself, that we don't realize how much our presence affects others. We do realize how much everybody else's presence affects me. We have no problem with that. But we don't realize just how much your presence, you know, affects the other. How much, what the difference between your smile and your frown, you know? The difference between your liking me and not liking me. It's huge. It's huge. And so becoming aware of that is a gift not just to yourself, but really to all beings. It's a gift to all beings. Yeah. Now, even when I say that, there's something that's always left out. It is a gift to all beings, but it is you are one of the beings that it's a gift to. For instance, you're ahimsa. It's practiced externally and internally. So it's a gift to you, you know, as well as to all beings. Shanti, externally and internally. I can accommodate you, but I hate myself. We don't think about it. We don't think about that. But actually, I'm accommodating you, but I'm hating myself. Then the self here means my mind or whatever I've done is being injured. I can give understanding to you, but no understanding to myself, that I am being injured. You know, my psyche is being injured. My body is being injured. We don't think about that. But if you do think about it, if you do start thinking about it, you are highly rewarded. Because just as if I like you and I enjoy you coming over and I'm happy to see you, then you will be relaxed by that. We all will. If I feel that way toward myself, toward my psyche, toward all the little ones inside, all the immature ones, all the ones that are working away, trying to be good, you know, if I give that same respect and care, then they all of these different parts inside also perk up, you know, because I'm on their side. It's so simple, you know. It's so, so simple. But we have to bring all of these things into consciousness because we're not used to it. We actually haven't been raised this way. I actually think that it would be good to raise children this way, to just have them have certain understandings that are natural as they grow up. Not any big philosophy, I don't mean that. Just certain understandings that would be so natural, you know, so that we don't have to learn this when we're in our 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s. You know? So these type of sensitivities that give the mind a certain shanti, but it really doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how old you are. When you learn it, you learn it. Mm-hmm. And the reward is immediate. It's not like, well, you're 60 now, and so it's going to take a long time for this to... It'll take a long time for this to work. It doesn't take any time. All it takes is for you to do it. That's all it takes. It's not a matter of time. It's just a matter of doing it. There's no sluggishness like there is in the physical world. It's not that way of the mind. You can be habituated to doing the opposite, but every time you don't do that, and you do that, that basic abhaya, that basic act of kindness, even internally or externally, it has an immediate effect. That's so beautiful. Dharma itself is so immediate. You know? You do an adharma, you suffer. You do dharma, you enjoy. Right away. So it's a very beautiful thing to understand. So that is kshanti. Do this next one really quickly. Maybe a little bit more next week. Arjavam. Arjavam comes from this riju. It means straight. For you to be straightforward. What straightforward means is that your mind, your speech, and your action are in line. So that there's no duplicity inside. To understand that really, though, it's not that I say everything I think. That would be terrible. You don't have to say everything you think, and you don't have to do everything you think, right? So in that direction, they don't have to line up. But on the other hand, what you do should be in line with what you say and in line with what you think. See what I mean? The action that you do take, or what you do say, what you choose to say, it should be true. Mm-hmm. Your action should be true to what you've said. You should do what you said you were going to do. And what you said you were going to do is in line with what you think. So it's a form of, it's what we call satyam. Satyam is really the primary to work. It's called vak tapas. You know, but just across the board it should be like this. But if you look at it just in terms of your speech, They say what you should. What should you say? What things you, should you say? Well, you should say something which is true. Whatever you say, it should be true. Or don't say it. If it's not true, just be quiet. Don't say it. So it should be true, but it should also be hitam. It should be beneficial. You know? It could be true, like I could say, you are a total jackass. You know? Now the question is, that could be true.
No benefit.
But what is the usefulness in that statement? And not only that, it should be priyam. It should be pleasing for the other person to hear, unless they're your parent or your teacher, as they say. Parent, it's not always going to be pleasing. Teacher also, sometimes it can be a little... Yeah. But then you've chosen that teacher. You should be, but for everybody else, it should be what you should say. It should be true. It should be hit them. It should be beneficial. And it should be pleasing. It should be not be an attack. Because what gives you the right, really, to attack somebody? What relationship do you have with that person to cause you to be talking in a way that is not true and that is not beneficial and that is not pleasing? What is the relationship that would allow for those transgressions? Now, so, say you say, okay, everything you say should be septim, hitam, and priyam. But there can be many, many things that you don't say. It's what you do say. You can be thinking many things. Many things. But what you do say should be true to what you think. If the things you decide to say, they should be true to what you think. They should be hitam, beneficial, and they should be pleasing. Or just don't say them. You don't have to talk. You don't have to say them. And then the things that you do should also, the things you choose to do, you don't choose to do everything that you think. But what you do choose to do should be true to what you say and to what you think. See what I mean? That's arjavam. Is that straight line. When you have that straight line, there's no conflict inside. You're clean all the way through. Yeah? There's no duplicity there. And so that if you can have that arjavam, it makes for just a lot of natural shanti. There's no complexities inside. It's very clean and straightforward. So that's also a beautiful, beautiful value to think about, you know, to think about and see, even to think about your own life, to what degree, you know, you have that kind of straightforwardness and work on it. Because as you develop that, again, you feel that your mind gaining a deep relaxation. Okay. So those are two more. I'll stop there. Three more. You did three. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.